So I think we have to start to recognize the choice is a fork between mutually assured destruction or mutually assured thriving. And if you want to preserve your wealth, there is only one pathway. You have to allocate capital to mutually assured thriving because everything else is self-terminating you and your future generations.
Welcome to Green Planet, Blue Planet podcast, all things regeneration. I'm here today with Indy Johar, mission steward at Dark Matter Labs. Welcome, Indy.
Hi, delighted to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
Yeah, I'm super excited to talk to you. And I want to jump right in and talk about what you call the boring revolution and kind of unpack, you know, why we actually need to maybe revolve and evolve what the boring parts and bits of our reality.
Yeah, no, delighted to get into it. I prefer it that way. Anyway, so why I think this is a kind of, I think we live in a world where we often see the revolutions as a revolution of things in the world around us. And I would argue this is one of those major transformation points where we talk about reimagining how we perceive ourselves and how we reimagine how we perceive our relationships with the world, and also thereby reimagine the institutional frameworks that reinforce those. And what I mean by that is if we imagine ourselves as individuals, we imagine ourselves as discrete from the world around us and separated from the world around us, and we imagine ourselves in positions of subject-object relationships, and we imagine ourselves as separated, we construct a thesis of the world. And if we imagine ourselves as dominion over the world and in ownership of the world, as opposed to being in treating the world, that reinforces a theory of property, a theory of labor, a theory of how we perceive the world as a world of dead things to which we are in dominion of. And what I would argue that this is not a transformation just of the things that we make and the things that we construct in the world around us. Yes, fundamentally, this is an energy transformation as we move from hydrocarbons to minerals, shift our nutrient economy from being hydrocarbon driven to being actually generatively driven on soils in different formats, build a biomaterial economy and shift our material economy, and also build a new human economy outside theories of instructable labor. So there is a foundational transformation going on in that way, but that is rooted in a different theory of how we organize the world and a different theory of institutions. And recognizing that, for example, our theory of property is an extension of both seeing the world from being ready to be enslaved in dominion and theories of actually separation. So if we want to talk about the scale of the revolution, I would say this is a revolution not just of things, but the things that are invisible and our imaginations of ourselves in radical senses. That's why I call it a boring revolution.
Yeah, and that's also why it's Dark Matter Labs, right? Like the invisible parts that we, you know, I guess supposedly also know very little about. I really, when I got in touch with your work and listened to some of your talks, I love that angle on bureaucracy as the boring bit that no one ever wants to actually tackle. But we have to understand it's such a real fundamental layer of this reality, right? I grew up in Germany. I'm in Mexico right now. Very different ways of interpreting bureaucratic layer of reality. But ultimately, that's the one that stops a lot of the progress from going around. What's some of the examples you could point at there to make this more felt and tactile to people?
So, and also, it's not just controls. It's also ennobling. So you could argue that, you know, Weber in Germany, when he was talking about the bureaucratic capacities of the state, remember, you know, the treasury function, the centralized treasury of state was a function of actually a kind of bureaucratic revolution that we've been living in over the last 200 years, you could argue. So our theory of bureaucracy, whether it's our theory of accounting, centralized accounts, or whether it's our theory of property registries, these are means of organizing the world. And what we've forgotten is that those means of organizing code the world around us. So a property register, if you imagine a property register as a register or red line of property, divisionality, or you recognize it as a network of relationships and responsibilities. That's a fundamental different theory of coding. So what we've coded in an analog world has been the simplicity of divisionality on maps, because that's what could be coded with efficiency. So our analog bureaucracy was coded. That's why the nation state, if you look at indigenous nation states, they were overlapping states. Whereas actually, as soon as cartography got on top of it, it created territorial states, which abutted to each other with divisible lines, because it didn't know how to deal with overlapping, rich, hyper-rich relational complexities. So our theory of bureaucracy is fundamentally coded and mapped into the world around us. And it's destroyed some of the relationality that was made possible pre-analog state. Now, what I think is a revolution is computational bureaucracy and computational capabilities are opening up the pathways for a new relationality, a computational relationality. And the registries and the imagination of those worlds is fundamentally different. So even our theory of contract can be fundamentally contingent, can be orientated around multiple flows of capital and responsibility. Rights and responsibilities can be verified through second order means, not necessarily through two-point optimization. So what a new bureaucratic capability, a computational bureaucracy, is opening up is a whole new field of possibilities. And that's why I think this kind of, as you rightly say, this kind of this boring component is we breathe it like air. We think of it as normal, but actually it's something we designed. And it's something we designed with great violence to the world around us when it was designed. And now we can redesign it again because we built the computational capacities to be able to reimagine those things. And that, I think, is a revolution at hand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, moving from the analog to the digital and then moving from the digital into, you know, the, you know, possibly the impending kind of future of both an AI singularity as well as a blockchain reality. Let's talk as real as we can about the threat of it being a continuation of what we had in the analog reality of you know, cartography. You mentioned kind of, you know, the violent way of how a lot of this was introduced. Do you see that threat that there are governments and you know, interest groups that would just prefer to continue the way we have divided things as an actual threat? Or do you see that the complexity of what, you know, AI, digital realities, blockchain allow us will inevitably kind of steer us free from that threat?
Yeah, no, I agree. I think the threats definitely exist. And the little pivot I see, though, is that our current computational realities and our current ways or our current bureaucratic realities are actually self-terminating us. So it's not that our current modalities, yes, they might look like they survive, but the level of externalities that are being generated around the world around us are so large that they are self-terminating us. So there is a more fundamental question on the table, which I think is going to require us to reimagine these things in radical formats.
What's the fundamental question?
And those fundamental questions are rooted, like what I'm trying to get to is that our theory of bureaucracy has been rooted in the theory of divisibility. Divisibility, understanding ourselves as individuals and objects. And those questions that have been rooted into our theory of bureaucracy are no longer viable. They're not marginally non-viable. You could argue climate change is just a symptom of a failure of a world that's generating such large, vast externalities that those externalities are self-terminating us. And by implication, that I think whilst there are lock-ins and many people want to preserve this reality because they're incentivized to preserve it, it's also very clear that it's very difficult for that worldview to persist because it's self-terminating. So I think that's one dimension that I think is worth us holding cleanly, in a sense that I think there are natural limits to this way of organizing, which I think we're already seeing, whether we're living at a 3-degree world or a 7-degree world, world temperature rise, we self-terminate ourselves in that reality. And that, I think, is worth us just being really clean on, because I think this isn't a choice. I think most people perceive this as a choice. And it's only a choice if you want to choose self-termination. Everything else requires a foundational shift.
Mm-hmm. I really like how clear and how kind of, you know, you used the word clean, how clean you pointed at that. I couldn't agree more. Absolutely in agreement with that. That is, it, the inevitable reality of continuing to choose the same choice will lead to destruction. And sure, maybe a chosen few can survive that, but that's not a reality we need to choose at all. How do you think?
Also,
yeah, go ahead.
Julian, even the chosen few, I think, is a really convenient illusion. So yeah. The chosen few, like New Zealand, right, was isolated in COVID. It didn't have microchips. It didn't have access to microchips. It didn't have access to paracetamol. It didn't have access to PPP, right? Mm. So that's just New Zealand right now. So what I'm saying is that there isn't a pathway for a chosen few might survive, but we're talking about surviving like it's going back into the Middle Ages. You just don't have antibiotics. You don't have, like, those are functions. Those microchip is a function of a planetary civilization, right? A microchip is a function of a planetary civilization. It's not a function of Taiwan, right? It's a function of a planetary civilization. Neon being shipped from one part of the world to palladium to, it's a function of a planetary civilization, as is paracetamol, as is all these drugs. So I think we have to start to recognize, and this is where I often talk about this, there is no viable New Zealand strategy. There is no viable New Zealand strategy for a few select thousand to survive. And the second dimension of this, which I think is equally important, is if we lose 7 billion people, right? This is often the remit I'm given. We're going to lose 7 billion. And I'm like, do we really think in a planet full of nuclear weapons, information weapons, bio warfare, if we lose 7 billion people, we're going to stop at 7 billion? I am almost certainly of the mind that if we lose 7 billion people, we lose the whole 8.5. Because once you trip with that much trauma into the world and that much trauma and violence in the world, there is no pathway for us to stop meaningfully at any viable figure. And the risk is too large. So I think it's just worth us recognizing, because I've been in rooms where I've heard, you know, I would say naive wealth who thinks there's a pathway. And I think there isn't a pathway. Run the game theory. And if people can prove me wrong that you can survive without antibiotics, without microchips in a meaningful way in a planetary civilization, there just isn't. So I think we have to start to recognize the choice is a fork between mutually assured destruction or mutually assured thriving. And if you want to preserve your wealth, there is only one pathway. You have to allocate capital to mutually assured thriving, because everything else is self-terminating you and your future generations. It's simple.
I mean, it's my podcast, I can swear. I fucking love it. I love how clear you lay out this pathway, you know? I couldn't be more on the same page. Let's talk about that mutually assured thriving and that pathway forward. You know, this is what we've dedicated this podcast to, is the healthy planet. Like, what are the regenerative systems we need? The reason why I started at the boring revolution is because after doing this for many years, I feel like a lot of people miss that layer, that the realities and the conclusions we make from the logical mind that allow us to move, you know, the boring layer forward are actually what stop us, because often that's in the way to real thriving steps forward. But let's talk about this thriving mutual pathway and how to allocate both financial assets as well as our energy, time, and sweat equity to it. You obviously work involved with many different layers of it, you know, politics and organizations across several interest groups. Where do you see anyone can join this kind of a journey? How do you see this becoming like a clear pathway forward for someone who's maybe possibly even still in the hypnosis of like modern capitalism and media at this point?
So I think I started a foundational layer here, which is that the work that we've been doing, I think one of the big questions I often get locked into is people going and go, there's either capitalism or there's communism.
Right.
There's this kind of passive polarization.
Duality. So, there's just two options.
There's these two options, right? So if it isn't capitalism, it's communism. And I'm like, okay, both capitalism and communism in various formats are predicated on the theory of property. The only difference between capitalism and communism is who controls property. The theory of property is still there, right? It's collective or it's individual. Right? The theory of labor exists in both systems. The theory of contract exists in both systems. The theory of what you have, and the theory of governance, right? Some theory of collective governance exists in both systems. And I would argue that both those systems are problematic because they still, both of them, treat the world through the language of dominion. Both those frameworks treat the world through the theory of humans being units of labor and instructable systems. And both those systems perceive the world from a world of resources and assets, right? So whether it's collective or individual, right? That's usually a resolution. That's a way to solve a problem, but it's still a worldview problem, which is rooted. Now, I think if we have to unlock this conversation, you have to focus on what we call life-ennobling economics. Economics which actually operates on a recognizing the agency of everything around us, seeing the world not through assets and objecthood, but seeing the world through a theory of agents and agency, inherent agency of everything. And then in that worldview, what you're talking about is orchestration and organization, not through a theory of dominion and instructability, but through the capacity of a system to learn and self-learn. Now, why this is important is that actually in a world of, I hate using these sort of buzzwords, but I'm using them just for convenience, like generative AI, the capacity of agent-based learning systems, we have created a new form of bureaucratic capability of the system around us to construct the world through a theory of agents and learning-orientated agents. The purification of the world from a theory of dominion and instructability through a plurality of mass multi-agent systems is actually now possible because of the Boring Revolution. That changes our theory of orchestration from theory of property, dominion, labor, instructability to a fundamentally different paradigm view. And this is not just for human systems, it's not just for non-human systems, it's also not only just for machine systems, where I'm saying all in across these paradigms, these things are fantastic, are fundamentally transforming our theory of orchestration. And I think this is the paradigm leap, this worldview shift that moves away from these two dualities to a different modus operandi, builds the pathway for a different form of coherence building and organizing function, because it posits the theory of radical, posits the theory of agency throughout the system. It orchestrates, it builds coherence in agency through learning capacity rather than control theory, which means that actually you can deal with the complexity and the entanglement of the world in a fundamentally different way. And that's a function of a new bureaucratic capability, which is orientated through the construction of agency and learning orientated or orchestration. That, I think, is a paradigm leap that breaks the whole dichotomy of capital versus communism, which I think is an outdated dichotomy relative to our bureaucratic capabilities and what's available on the table. And that, I think, is a paradigm leap.
Mm-hmm. That's a paradigm shift that I think every single one of us will, in one way or other, have to onboard in the next couple of years. Because as you're saying, these are buzzwords, right? Like generative AI, language learning models, et cetera. But they are changing the way the world is kind of going around. And if we look back 30 years before the internet became a mass phenomena, it was maybe hard to see for many, but 30 years later, we can say now there's like 5 billion people online. Everything has changed. And we're in front of another revolution like this with AI and a point of singularity. How do you see this incoming? You explained it really clearly. What are the steps of it and how it kind of opens the paradigm to now create a different, kind of move entirely beyond, I guess, dualism in general, right? Because we'll maybe have to just question who are we as humans and what is our role as humans on the planet when we have generative abilities through technology like AI.
I think there is a fundamental question of being what it means to be human. I think this whole debate for me is about reimagining ourselves and reimagining ourselves as multitudes, firstly. I'm not a him or a her, I'm a we. And recognizing ourselves as plural is really critical, because only in recognizing our plurality is that we start to understand we live in, and then to recognize not only our plurality, then our relationality. Recognizing it is not my intelligence. My intelligence is a function of our relationship in this conversation. And your intelligence is a function of our relationship in this conversation. So these are relational capabilities rather than divisible capabilities. And then the third dimension is recognizing myself and ourselves as developmental agents. We are becomings, not beings. We're not situated, we're becoming agents. So if we recognize those three fundamental transformations at the reconceptualization of being human, and we adopt that as a mirroring pathway to how we see the world, we end up with a fundamental different worldview. And the one final thing I'd say on this, and we can sort of obviously dive in deeper. For me, this is not a moral landscape. Like, this is not like, hey, I think this is morally more appropriate or not. I think this is the most efficient way of organizing for vital plurality and complexity. And if we want to live in a complex civilization, this is the most effective way of orchestrating in complex civilizations. And this, I think, is the paradigm shift of there are limits to the amount of energy a system can take to coordinate itself. And we're reaching the moment where actually our energy inputs of coordination have become excessive relative to the value that could be constructed. And that is breakdown. We are no longer able to coordinate ourselves because the externalities are so high. And this is a paradigm leap in being able to actually reimagine our coordination function through a radical democratization, radical agentification of the world. And actually that allows us to unleash vast amounts of value that's untapped in the system in radical different ways. So this is not a moral debate. It's like it's a sort of hyper-utilitarian debate done at a deep level. And that, I think, is really important. I'm not arguing this from isn't it good? It is good, but it's also the most effective way of organizing.
It sure is good. And, you know, it sure is effective. I think there's a few different routes we could go at this point of the conversation, but I'll make sure to come back to some of those questions. I'd love to kind of dive a little bit deeper into, you know, both the idea of dominion and then the idea of network states. And I'll frame it a little bit more because yes, there is a more effective way than dominion. And because we exist in a we and in a relationship to everything, it is actually a logical consequence. However, those who currently rule the dominion might not see it this way. And personally, I don't think that's going to stop us at this point in our human thriving and journey. But there might be a kind of force counterforce equation for a continuation of a while, right? And so, because what you're saying is logically proof, it's morally proof, but not everyone who holds dominion might want to see it like that quite yet. Do you think network states and the way that, you know, Balaji Srinivasan kind of explains network states in his book and his work are a logical consequence of a few people gathering and forming groups that can become sovereign to other states and sovereign on a political and bureaucratic level? Or do you think this is just one of the many ways this is going to break through?
I don't know Balaji's. I mean, I know of Balaji's work a little bit. I don't know it well enough. But my worry about that worldview, it's still rooted in a worldview with narrow rationalities, narrow self-optimizations, narrow theories of seeing the world and the network state as humans and human systems. It hasn't expanded, as I saw it, into a much deeper format. And secondly, in a complex emergent world, when you are in relationship to the world and treaty with the world, as opposed to in extractive self-optimization systems, the theory of contract goes from being a theory of optimization to a theory of care. That's a fundamentally different type of relationship in the world. So my slight, I think there are some paradigms in that worldview that I think are really critical, but I also worry that a lot of that worldview has been constructed from a hyper-libertarian fractional value perspective and fractionalization perspective, which doesn't reimagine a radical new whole on the other side of that story. So that's where I'm slightly friendly, would love to be more critical and have more engaged about it. So that's where I am with that. I just want to name that because I think it's really critical.
I'm glad you are. I think you're spot on. And I think this is always going to be the danger when there's this, you know, as you call it, hyper-liberal, but then also like, you know, the kind of technological aspect of self-organizing comes first rather than the relational aspect of like, we are fundamentally in a relationship with each other and the planet at large, right?
And if you code it for fractionality, so most of the Web3 space, as I see it, has been coding a hyper-narrow rationality, a self-interested, self-optimizing, a micro sort of homo economist worldview, and encoding that into hyper-micro fractionalities and incentive systems, which actually are, I think, are very small representations of small kinds of beings. And, you know, and I think there are much broader, richer rationalities of being human than I think are being left aside by those coders of a hyper neo-libertarian landscape that I think are missing dimensions that are really vital for this transition. And this is why I talk about the reimagination of being human as being as vital as the reimagination of the boring revolution or the kind of coding revolution. But I do want to come back to your very important point, which is that those that are in dominion of the world and their relationship of dominion and control, how will they feel about this transition? I think there are, and how will they engage with this transition? And I think the thing that I'm more and more, you know, a lot of the work at DM is coming more and more to as well, is that recognizing that perhaps what we're living in is a moment where there isn't a single party system of control. There's no one at the wheel. Let's use that metaphor. And what we're going to see is what I would say is major event-driven transitions, where major events or the flashpoints of major events, like the precursors of major events, will shift Overton windows to allow for radical new ways. You could argue COVID opened up a landscape of universal basic income being tried in different parts of the world, in all parts of the world, in different landscapes of the code. So this event opened up the Overton window for radical opportunities. I think what we're going to see is these forms of transitions, which are event-driven, which will shift over into windows and allow us to reconfigure. And if these event windows are significant and planetary, because of the diffusion of innovation capacity, they happen in one landscape, they will effectively roll across the planet in rapid formats. So that's two dimensions. The third dimension that I think is really important is that I think the asset classes or the value classes that exist in this next paradigm are fundamentally different from the asset classes that exist in the old paradigm. So if you are a dominion wealth holder of the 19th and 20th century, it is not necessary that your theory of wealth will persist in the 21st century. In fact, I would argue that most of the financial assets that we're about to see are incredibly fragile, if not downright liabilities, because or carrying massive losses, because fundamentally we are mispricing the scale of risk that's on the table. So the quant models are fundamentally not adequately pricing the risk, which means that actually most of the financial assets that sit on those and our theories of what we think is valuable and not valuable is actually fundamentally miscoded. And we're not hedging those risks sufficiently, either through real world options or financial options. So I think if you look at it, if I was somebody who was in dominion of wealth, I would encourage you to look very carefully at what you think wealth was and what you think wealth will be. And wealth in an entangled world operates fundamentally different to wealth in a dominion world and a sort of separated world. And the theory of public and private no longer exists in a theory of entanglement. How do you think wealth will operate with legitimacy? And final point I'd make is the greatest danger to us is not environmental breakdown. That will happen. What will happen as a precursor to environmental breakdown will be social breakdown. And everything about wealth is constructed on social norms and social rules and social applications of utility. So if you are a wealth holder, you need to start to see this landscape in fundamentally these different ways, which is why I think even from self-interested rationality of dominion holders, it's worth starting to think quite differently and paradigmatically. And even ignoring the fact that we're in mutually assured thriving if you persist in that landscape of mutually assured destruction if you persist in that landscape of current allocation theories.
Yeah, absolutely. There's kind of on the horizon of where you just went with this topic, there's one of my favorite topics, which has to do with, you know, earth equity and understanding that we've never, accounted, literally in accounting, we've never accounted for the true natural value that Earth and the non-human world around us has. For example, I was just recently in Oaxaca in Mexico, there's a tree called Tule, and it's supposedly one of the oldest trees in the world. It's several thousands of years old. There's a big fence around it, and you have to pay like $1 or $2 to go be with it, which, you know, it's just the way that local community solved it. But you could tell this town square felt so different than every other town square in Mexico. There was like a richness in the way that people were with each other. There was a peacefulness that was superseded other places. And maybe it had a lot to do with how they simply gave a lot of value to this tree being like the host of this town square, right? And so what role do you think Earth Equity plays? And I know it's a beginning movement. You know, we have some, there's some projects out of New Zealand and out of other places, I think in Ecuador, where these legal steps have been started, where, you know, people have started to understand we need to have a legal ability to defend nature against the corporate kind of mechanisms. Can you guide us a bit deeper into this topic? Because I think it's one of the most fascinating ones that makes it so visible that like we're actually in relationship with the entire Earth.
Yeah, no, I think this is a really important topic, and it has lots of really beautiful nuances. So one thing is that one of the biggest problems that we've got is we only account in financial terms. So, and it's not that you and I only account in financial terms. You and I live in hybrid currencies of value and care, but our resource allocation, our attribution systems are so residually abstracted to accounting only in financial terms that we're optimizing for one currency, which is finance, and we're de-optimizing and undervaluing all sorts of other currencies that coexist. By currencies, I mean currencies of care, currencies of love, currencies of other forms of current flows that exist in the system. And not only do they exist, they are vital for the system to exist, i.e. without those other currencies, the system doesn't exist. The financial value doesn't exist, in fact. So I think there is a really interesting question about how we operationalize and organize the world at a multi-currency level. And I think it's really important to also recognize this is a planetary organizational problem. It's not just a romance of the 15th century of how we fall back in love with our local around. We have to be able to do this at a planetary scale. That, I think, is the quantum leap that we're facing, is we have to fall back in love. All of us have to fall back in love and our relationship with the Amazon. All of us. It's not just a few. And that planetary cognition capability, I think, is really critical. So I want to start by saying that. Second, I think there's a sort of interesting question that we're holding a lot on is the rights of nature, and are we giving rights to nature? This is the whole problem, I think, with what I'd call the rights discourse. Who gives the rights? Because is it that we have implied rights to which we're allocating, or do we recognize the inherent rights of something, which is a different theory? Then I think there's also a different question about legal personhood. So does a river have a legal personhood, or does it have a multitude of legal personhoods, i.e. recognizing a river has millions of relationships? And the problem with a legal personhood is you still create the theory of singularity and the singular being, which actually is part of the problem of not recognizing the plurality of even you and I. So the theory of bottlenecking the whole of the river through a single person and creating the governance through a board system of a single river system creates a really interesting question about how do you govern relationality of a river. And a lot of the work that we're doing is on how do you build these mechanisms, but how do you build a governance relationship, which is recognizing the relationalities of a river as opposed to centralized control systems. And that's, I think, really critical. And then I think there is also a really massive question about recognizing the space for violence. And I think this is really difficult, which is that what happens in a difficult situation where you have to take down a forest or part of a forest? How do you actually build the pathways to be able to do that in a way that recognizes the contribution, but also recognizes in extraordinary circumstances something needs to be done? And not assuming a non-violent future, but recognizing there are pathways and practices that we need to learn, that we may have a moment of violence to which we may need to then compensate and effectively re-nurture that landscape, and an obligation to restore and enhance that landscape in different ways. So how do we build a meaningful, not just a strategy of conservation and separation, but a meaningful relationship of actually generative relationships, recognizing both violence also exists in those realities. And I put that down because I too often find these conversations have historically been so focused on preservation. And I get it. We need to preserve as much of our ecosystems. But if we want this to be actually a planetary scale adoption, we're going to have to find a new pathway, which is more than just conservation, but to be in regenerative relationship with it, recognizing moments of violence, but also recognizing the responsibilities when you take on moments of violence to actually other things. And the, you know, Indigenous communities and Indigenous leadership has, and First Nation leadership has a lot to teach us about that in ways that I think are really powerful and for us to recognize. And then this also recognizes how we, you know, how do we construct the registry frameworks? How do we recognize these sort of rights? How do we build all these things? I think this is all part of the pathway for development. So that's just the nuance I talk about. And then I think it also opens up, how do you resource these things? So too often, like river rights and water rights, they're divisional systems. They're all about, you have this many liters, I have this many liters. They aren't generative systems. They're not based on contribution systems. They're not based on, this is my contribution to the health of the river, this is your contribution, because they're all about allocations and rights and separations, as opposed to generative relationships. So how do we start to take a different theory of commoning, which isn't based on divisional rights, but common contributions and common and different forms of generative frameworks? And that, I think, is really key in many of these things. So I think we are going to move into a world of agentification. We are going to move into a world of multi-agent systems around a river. We are going to take a generative approach to that framework. That's going to change a lot of our relationships. That goes back to the earlier conversation we're having. And I think nature-based systems, and also whether it's the autonomous car or the autonomous three-wheeler or the autonomous bike, these are all going to be pathways into that future. They're going to represent the same modality of organizing that will grow around us.
Yeah. I think you're so eloquently addressing all of these problems in its complexities and the layers, and how they, you know, always lead back to the fundamental paradigm behind it, right? And so one of the things I've learned in the last decade is that this kind of change, it doesn't happen at all places at once. And maybe it can, but it usually happens with certain kind of outliers, certain kind of pioneers trailblazing into one direction, showing, like you said earlier in your logical argument, that it is just, it's morally the right step, but it's also logically the right step, right? It's a reorganization that, and we can tell that that's real when we are in touch with, you know, Indigenous communities, or when we're in touch with communities that have taken this into account, is that there is a perceived and an experienced, like the actual interbeing of the quality of life in spaces that have taken into account multiple angles, not just the monetary or financial angle. It's maybe hard to numerate it, but it's so visibly felt, so clearly a felt experience. And that is what our relationship with nature is.
Yeah, totally agree. And I think I couldn't agree more. And I think this world is going to be born. I think this world will be born in different locations. So you're absolutely right. Geographies, let's call them that. I think it'll be born. A lot of our work is focused on, you know, critical events that are likely to come.
Yeah.
You can talk also about not only critical event locations, say places like the Himalayas, which will be a critical event location. Or you can talk about actually places like, you know, cultural institutions. I think cultural institutions are going to actually create the pathway of tomorrow being made visible. I think we're also going to see the crossover in Indigenous and common law frameworks, and actually those crossover locations where a new way forward is seen possible at the intersection, you know, of what I would call quantum and relational theory coming together to actually build a new pathway. So I think we're going to see, and then there are going to be locations like cities and places where actually the lead, the capacity where the kind of cascading risks are so high that the future has to be made visible. So I think we're going to see these different geographies that are going to chart the world forward. Major crises, cultural institutions, sort of crossover geographies between sort of, you know, between different worldviews where these two worldviews coincide and crossover, and then effectively locations with the lead societies because of actually the cascading risks are so large, the need to respond is so large. And across those landscapes of four or five kind of geographies, I think we're going to see the future being born in different aspects. And then the diffusion effects of this, I think, are going to be very much faster than people are imagining.
Yeah, yeah. There's two things I still would love to touch on, and one of them you just mentioned, and that's kind of the risk in different geographies. You mentioned the Himalayas as an example. Do you mind elaborating a little bit? Because I think there's clear risk in different locations if it's sea level rising or if it's, you know, drought and no access to water, etc. Specifically in the Himalayas, what are you hinting at?
So the Himalayas is a watershed for about 3 billion odd people. The glaciers are becoming fragile. And with the loss and with the fragility of glaciers, we will not only get glacial floods, which will have significant impact downstream, we will also certainly over time lose glacial predictable water systems. That has massive implication for agriculture and also water supply. And it is also the apex, it sits at the apex of planetary scale conflict between various parties that are dependent on that. So when you put those things together, you start to see it as a major event location, which needs a new theory of governance and organization to be able to avoid that future. So I argue that there are locations around the world of that nature and typology that are going to be the precursors of new forms of planetary scale innovation, as historically the River Danube was. I mean, so the River Danube was actually, you know, bilaterally governed, became a source of conflict. People came to war in the 19th century, middle of the 19th century. And then from that, the theory of international waters was born, which meant that effectively the River Danube was governed as an international water, which actually reduced conflict and created a new paradigm of governance around water systems. So I would say that there is a kind of historic pathway that we're seeing, and I think we're going to see locations like that. A lot of the work that we're doing around planetary civics is looking at these sorts of locations and how do you build, reimagine the governance frameworks around those from being allocational and divisional to being generative and proactive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, beautifully put. You know, each and every of these topics we touched on today, we could have an hour-long conversation in itself. I want to, you know, pull forward like a very real case example of something in the world that has created a new form of exchange, a new form of relationship, a new form of maybe even city planning or development planning, and specifically trust. And I've heard you talk about this before, but it's Airbnb, or we could also take Uber in the sense of transport, right? Like 20 years ago, for anyone to rent an apartment from a total stranger in a totally foreign country, that bore all kinds of risks. Today, you can literally do so by like three button clicks, and you read a bunch of reviews and you're like, oh, I can trust this person. And it actually turns out to reliably, repeatably be a trustworthy experience, at least like, you know, 99% of it. And so it's these really simple technological upgrades. I mean, Airbnb also is a massive company at this point, but that bring a relationship into the physical space and that show this relationship wants to be had. It wasn't possible yet. Here's the innovation to make this happen. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, but also, you know, where you see other opportunities like that are literally just in front of us, because people want to have those relationships, but we're still just maybe not capable to see how easily they are and how simply they are in front of us.
Yeah, I would argue, you know, Uber, Airbnb, these are all fundamentally bureaucratic innovations. They're really about their matching systems of allocation of resources in new ways. And they're using technology or code as a capacity to be able to do that. In fact, most of the code, you know, they're relying on Google Maps and they're relying on other forms of digital infrastructure to be able to even do the GPS and other forms of technologies to be able to construct those things. So these are genuinely institutions of the 21st century. Our problem is that we've built these institutions with exploitative capital, which I think is one of the kind of key questions that we face, but how we build new forms of capital allocation for these new types of institutional capabilities is a really fundamental question. But I think these are the precursors of new forms of institutional landscapes. So that's one thing. Second thing, I think these are literally just the beginning infrastructures. So whether you look at, I think you can code some of this stuff. We're doing a lot of work around new forms of permissioning. How do you construct social permission to use public realm in cities? How do you reimagine the permissioning of use, changing our theories of planning and planning orchestration by creating all forms of layers or very sensitive layers of permissioning systems, all the way from self-identification, self-warrantying, all the way through to third-party warrantying to state underwritten systems. So you can suddenly create these layered frameworks of permissioning, which are now coded and possible to do, which dramatically increases the capability of use of a city in really radical formats. That's some of the work that we're doing. I think what we can start to do is new forms of many-to-many contracting, which means that, you know, I personally think the world we're looking at is a new class of assets. So tree canopy of a city can be perceived as a new form of infrastructure, or the collective intelligence of a city can be perceived as a new form of capability, because you can suddenly look at aggregative outcomes, aggregative benefits, aggregative beneficiaries, and look at the multiple investment points that allow you to construct that. So I think the theory of the kind of contingent contract or the codified contract, the computational contract, is going to change our theory of value and value distribution. I think it also moves us away from debt to fixed instruments. It moves us away into revenue sharing systems, micro revenue sharing systems, which create more forms of equitable non-revenue capture, sort of what I'd call colonization capital. I think it will decentralize monetary production in a really radical way. So the monetary story of this stuff, so new assets, new frameworks, new permissioning systems, new forms of capital structures, all of this stuff is coming out our door at a rapid rate. And it's going to be massively accelerated by the need side, because the need for these new asset classes is so vital. That's coming at us, that all these structured economic systems are going to be multi-currency systems. So they won't just talk about financial value, they'll talk about other forms of value and be able to respond to those other forms of value. So these are structured computational economic systems, which I think is made possible. That's how we can finance what I would say is infrastructure-like investments, which are avoid becoming rent-seeking, rent-extracting systems, because they're legible, they're transparent, they're auditable in different formats. I think there's a whole pathway to a new economy emerging. We've just begun that story. Mm-hmm. And I think this is where spatial computing and all the things that it involves will open up.
Yeah, this is an exciting time to be alive in. And there's lots of challenges, but with all of them come lots of opportunities. Indeed, before we check out here for today, you're so clearly a living example of purpose, of applied purpose, of just like leaning in, being in all of these like moving pieces. For everyone listening who is, you know, kind of either in that place or at the brink of being in this place, or maybe completely removed from purpose, and it's like, how do I even find myself in this? What's your two cents of advice, and how did that process happen for you, where you were like, this is my topic, this is where I want to apply myself, and kind of help people see that light?
Okay, so two basic things that I learned. One, in an entangled world, everything matters. Pick anything. It doesn't really matter. Everything touches everything. So there is no priority. There's no secret sort of acupuncture point. Literally everything touches. So it's like that grain through the, you know, the rice of a grain of rice, I can see the whole world. It is true. So in an entangled world, it is true. Touch anything, you can perceive it this way. That's really important. Number two, I'd say it's really critical that I think we do things which are commensurate to the scale of the challenge that we face. And one of the biggest risks I see is the level of delusion in the space, that we are doing things because that's what we think we're capable of. So we're saying, I know this is what the world wants, but this is what I think I can do. And I don't think that's no longer viable. I don't think that's viable. I think we have to become commensurate. We have to look the problem space in the eyes and be commensurate to the problem space. And it's really vital that we all become commensurate to the scale of the challenge that we face. And I think this is the second thing. The final thing I'd say is get in touch. You know, I think there's so many brilliant people, you know, around. Most of us are always in dialogue, always talking to people, always trying to help each other out. And I think, you know, please get in touch. Please get in touch with yourself, Julian. Please get in touch with me. And there's many other people that's on your podcast. Most people are willing to engage. And so if you're wanting to be part of this conversation, get in touch.
Well, Indy, thank you so much. Thanks for this call, the participation. There's a lot of head nodding, a lot of agreement, but I just really like the way you walked us through some of the most complex things in this episode and just show the like logical pathway forward with this incoming reality of simply being able to solve these problems in a completely new complexity. And so this was a great episode for me. Thank you for being on Green Planet, Blue Planet.
Honestly, a pleasure. Thank you for inviting me and thank you for letting us have this conversation. I think it's important. Thank you.